This is the Concealed Carry Podcast, episode number 17. Welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the USA Firearm Training Network, and I am your host, Riley Bowman. And I am also joined today by Jacob Paulson, and also by a new voice on the podcast, Matthew Marister with Lucos Tactical. Thank you so much for joining us, Matthew. Matthew, would you take just a quick second and give us a little introduction on yourself?
Yeah, thanks, guys. I've been listening for a while now and enjoy the show, and it's cool to kind of finally be on here with you guys. So I appreciate it. I'm out in Columbus, Ohio, teaching marksmanship. My background, I was in the Marine Corps infantry, got out as a staff sergeant, got to go over to Iraq and do some good stuff over there. And once I got out of the Marine Corps, natural progression kind of pushed me towards becoming a police officer, and I was out in San Diego County, so I was a police officer out there. I was a firearms instructor in the Marine Corps, and at the police department, got to do some crisis negotiation and things like that. So I've always been in a kind of tactics and more of a practical application of firearms training and things like that. So I moved back to Ohio when we had my daughter, and wanted her to grow up with some family and everything. So naturally, when I got back here, decided to open up my own marksmanship training company. And past 2 years, that's what I've been doing, is teaching concealed carry and advanced defensive pistol classes, and trying to get people sped up on the practical application of using their pistol rather than just, you know, going to the range and shoot, plinking a couple rounds at a target. So it's been a great opportunity for me. And I appreciate having me on the show today.
Cool. And we're so excited to have you as well. You have a fascinating background. And also, just so everybody knows, if they haven't noticed already, Matthew contributes a lot to the USAFirearmTraining.com website. And a lot of editorial stuff, video reviews, and we really appreciate that. He always has some really good input for the content on our site. So thanks again, Matthew. So today, we've got all kinds of interesting news stories coming up, as this is the episode that will be released on Monday, May 16th. So it's our news episode. Coming up today, we've got a concealed carrier saves the day yet once again as a man defends himself from three attackers. Kids, listen up. Robbing armed people often doesn't end well for you. A great grandma stops a vicious attack on herself and her husband. That's a really good story, by the way. I'm looking forward to getting into that one. And we got a ton of legislative updates, a lot of them from New Hampshire. New Hampshire's been really busy this year, guys. And so much more coming right up. But first, in today's episode, we'll be featuring for the first time ever a book titled Purchasing Guide, which is a guide for how to purchase your concealed carry or self-defense weapon. So stay tuned for later in the episode for information on how to get a hold of that book. And as always, each week on the news episode of the week, we feature a training tip. Last week, we talked about moving to cover and how important it is to do so properly to minimize your exposure. But once you get to that cover, and we kind of hinted at some things there, but I thought, you know, hey, it really would make sense to talk about this separately as its own topic. So this week's training tip is effectively using cover. And I'm going to turn it over, Matthew. I'm going to put you right on the spot, man. How do you effectively use cover?
Well, thanks for putting me on the spot right there. No, but, you know, just having cover, getting to the cover is important, obviously. But what do you do once you're there? You know, there's different techniques that you can use in using cover as far as getting out, how to address the threat once you're behind the cover. You know, do you completely lean out over the cover? On top of the cover, are you going to go on the side? There's big considerations as far as what you're exposing as you go to address the threat, because it's great to get behind the cover, but eventually you're going to have to at least have part of your body exposed, right? I mean, you can't shoot, you know, just with your hand over top of the cover and start shooting. You have to observe the target, so or the threat. So it's important to kind of work on getting behind the cover, and then, you know, if you're going to lean to the side and address that threat from the side, exposing the least amount of your body as possible, while still keep an eye on the threat and make sure it's not moving and losing sight of that. But it's really important to you know, effectively use the cover once you get there.
Yeah, I like that you said exposing the, you know, the least amount of body as possible. I think sometimes I've seen people do drills, you know, where they're shooting from behind cover, and something about the idea that you're holding a gun in your hand seems to give the shooter immense amount of confidence to feel like just popping up and standing up and, you know, exposing half the body is not an issue. I don't know. There's something intuitively unnatural about keeping as much of the body protected as possible.
Well, I mean, what do people see on TV and in movies? You know, they see cops, supposed cops, right? Of course, they're actors, and they're down behind a car, usually the car door, right?
Right.
Like we talked last week. And so when it's there, you know, I like, this is how you know, gunfights in movies and TV work. You know, each side takes turns, right?
Right.
One
right.
side, you know, bang, 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 and then they get behind their cover, and then the other side jumps up, bang, 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 and then they get behind cover. And that's not how it is in real life. And so people think they have, you know, they may have this impression that, okay, I'm behind cover. When it's time to shoot, I'm going to jump up and bang, bang, bang. You know, but in reality, there's a couple techniques you want to be aware of when using cover. And I like to use sometimes as an example, particularly if I've got a class with multiple students, and I'll have the students play both parts. So I'll have them be an observer or a shooter, and then I'll have, you know, as far as like they're the bad guy, and then I'll have the other student be, I guess, the good guy, and the good guy will be behind cover, and the bad guy will be just, you know, downrange somewhere. And we'll do this with training weapons or whatever, right? So obviously we're not pointing, you know, guns at one another, but you have the good guy behind cover, and their goal is to expose as little as possible while they are trying to find and identify and shoot at the bad guy. And so let's just say you're using like a barrel or something. It could represent anything. You know, you're behind the corner of a wall of a building, you know, a brick building or something, or you're behind the engine of the car or something. And so you're trying to maybe lean around the side of this object. Well, as they come around the side, you know, it's eye-opening for most people the first time they ever do this, or if they're not terribly experienced, they'll be like, oh my gosh, I see your leg, I see your hip, I see,
exactly.
You know, and so that really kind of helps people understand just how difficult it is sometimes to actually try to keep your body, you know, as much as possible behind the cover. And so along with that, let's actually talk about the technique of coming around cover. The technique I use the most is called slicing the pie. You familiar with that technique, I imagine, Matthew?
Absolutely, yes.
I knew it.
I think, you know, if I can interject here real quick, because I know that you're going to get into more detail. I found for me what really helped training this technique was using a mirror. Like, pick a wall in a house where there's a mirror on the other side of that wall. Mm-hmm. And pie that corner, and you can see yourself in the mirror and pretty readily find out, you know, how well you're doing.
Yeah. So let's get into it. That's a great suggestion too. What is, as Jacob describes it, pieing the corner or slicing the pie? Matthew, how are you taught that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's critical whenever you're trying to engage a threat from around the corner, because you don't know, especially if you've lost sight of the threat, and you don't know exactly where it is, and you're going to be coming around the corner. This probably works if you're doing dry fire in your house, or when you're training for, you know, your home defense drills, and you're trying to maybe clear your rooms or try to do something like that, where you actually see, you know, I don't know if there's a threat exactly where it is in the room, but as you know, you're taking short little views as you slowly inch out, and you're using as much as that of that corner as you can to protect yourself while exposing the least amount of your body, until you can either see the threat or engage the threat. Because if you come around that corner too much, You're exposing way too much, and that threat could, you know, typically be waiting for you and see you before you see them. You know, slicing the pie is exactly what you're doing. You're taking tiny little slices of that angle to kind of give yourself behind cover as much as you can.
Yeah, and if you were to draw a diagram of a top-down view of a person effectively using slicing the pie as a technique, that's what it would look like. As the person moves a little, you would basically draw slices of a pie, showing it that they are gradually, you know, revealing more and more and more as they come around that cover. And that it is such an important technique that, you know, honestly, you need to spend time really working with to get the hang of it, so that you are minimizing your exposure, as we've already mentioned. Are there any other techniques or anything that we want to consider here, guys? I'm just curious.
I have two other thoughts to interject. I'm sure that you guys also do too. I bet even Riley is just priming the pump here, but actually has more to say. So one other thought, I think that is probably a huge misconception. One of the biggest things I see people do wrong all the time when we're training is they come up on cover and they immediately put their back against it. Right. Because that's what they do in the movies, right? You run up on that cover and then you lean against it, you know, like so you can see the camera that's recording the film. but the problem is you don't want to see the camera in a real life situation. You want to see the threat. So the next thing I would interject is that when you're on cover, you want to actually be facing the threat. Even though there's a barrier between you and the threat, you want to be able to see if they make a run for it, if they move to a different position, if they're trying to move on you. You want to be able to be in a position where you can respond and shoot as quickly and effectively as possible. And that means you need to constantly be facing the threat.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with that totally. You know, just because you're behind cover at one point might not mean that is the best cover. That might have been the most opportune cover that you could get to. And if you're not looking at the threat and trying to constantly reassess your position, you should be constantly trying to improve your position. If you see something that's maybe better cover, or maybe you're taking, you know, depending on what type of ammunition or caliber gun that the person's using, your cover might degrade over time if you're just sitting back there. So you might want to move to a better position. So I think, you know, constantly keeping your head focused downrange, trying to focus on that threat and look at potential, you know, better places or place you can either maybe get to cover or escape this situation altogether. Maybe you have a handgun against somebody who has an automatic an AR or something, and you just simply overpowered, and getting into a one-on-one battle with this person probably isn't a wise choice. You might want to move to a place where you can, you know, extract yourself from this entire situation. And you can't do that if you're looking back for a camera.
That's right.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen too many people do this except for like really brand new, you know, newbie shooters, where the only thing they know is what they've seen on the TV screen. So I got a couple other things or questions to bring up. Well, first of all, my comment is the one thing that's really important to remember about slicing the pie, particularly as it relates to coming around a corner, is that the edge, whatever the edge is of your cover that is being used, that is your pivot point. That is, you know, as you're basically rotating around that as you are trying to look for whatever is that it is that might be hiding behind this cover from your view. And so the reason why that's critical is, with that being the pivot point, here's the danger or the common mistake is that people will sometimes, instead of kind of leaning out around that cover, they'll kind of like walk around it a little bit if they're not careful. And so they'll be too upright, too much of their body is exposed. And so when I'm doing this, you know, I've really got to use my waist and just lean right over to where, you know, my gun is basically going sideways to an extent. And I'm just literally trying to put just enough, you know, exposing just enough of my gun and my eye, whatever I'm sighting with, around that corner, so that there's very minimal exposure to my body. Also, too, a common mistake, we talked about it last week, and that is getting right up on cover. Like, you know, and you see this very often, yeah, too, in on the TV screen. And you get right up, and actually sometimes you use the cover as a gun rest and things of that nature. And that, you know, if you're taking a long distance shot, okay, there's nothing wrong with using something for a rest. But ideally, when using cover, you don't want to be right up on it. You probably want to be a little bit off of it, because one, that allows you to actually effectively use the slicing pie, the pie technique. But also things that deflect off that cover, a bullet, if the bullet's not stopped in that cover, if it's deflecting, the further you are off of the cover, the wider the angle is between you and that bullet that just got deflected. You're less likely to catch shrapnel in your face and in your eye, you know, and crap like that. So that's another important thing to understand. Sometimes when
I
can't agree more.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Thanks. Sorry, I was just going to throw out there too, you know, sometimes we'll use like a window we'll set up a little wall, plywood, whatever. And so you're kind of using a window opening as cover, or as you're coming through that window. Well, what I see so often is the hands and the arm and the gun all goes right through that window. And I was like, you know, why?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, like, stay off of it a little bit. And that's really the best way of using it. So here's one final question that I have. And then I definitely want to open it up to you guys. I want to get your guys' thought. I'm a right-handed shooter. So coming around cover that's on my left as I'm leaning out towards my right is no problem. What about coming around on the left of cover? Some guys will say, hey, you could switch hands. Okay. What are your guys' thoughts? What do you do?
Well, I've trained both ways. I've trained to switch the gun and engage, you know, that threat from the left side of the cover with shooting it left-handed. And I mean, through practice, you can get pretty proficient. Obviously not as good as your dominant side or however you normally shoot. I think it might have an application in certain situations, but I think that you can effectively use your, you know, shoot from a left side cover, or barricade or whatever you want to call it. Even if you're holding the gun on your right hand side, are you going to expose more? Yeah, obviously. But I think it's, you know, a case by case scenario. If, you know, you really have to minimize and you're really worried and that person's really focusing on your position, and knows where you are and just hammering kind of that position, you might, and you have to engage, probably switch it over. But if you know, you always shoot better how you naturally shoot, and most people aren't probably going to train left hand barricade scenarios as much. So I think you're probably better off going with what you normally train with and still, you know, practice the other way in those special scenarios. But I think that you can apply both in specific situations.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a really good summary. I think the takeaway is, you know, all of us need to be training proficiency with our weak side or with our weak hand, not just pie and corners, but just general all shooting related things. And pie and corners is part of that. But, you know, that said, is it significantly worse to, you know, hold the gun in your strong hand and come around a barricade or cover to the weak side? I don't think it's significantly worse. I think it's a minor difference in terms of what you're exposing. So I think that was a really good summary.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you, with you both, actually. I personally don't shoot around cover that is, you know, where I'm moving to my left around that cover. I don't switch hands, I'll be honest. I feel like with practice, a person can learn to still expose very little amounts of their body. Yeah, you might expose just a little more of your head, which that's not ideal, I suppose. But I do feel that I'm a more effective fighter with the gun in my strong hand, even though I've spent hours and hours and hours training with my weak side hand. And I can shoot pretty well that way, but I still think I'm more effective with my strong hand, regardless, no matter what, and thus I'm more likely to succeed in eliminating the threat that way than the alternative. And the other thing is too, this has always been my struggle with pieing a corner, is when I'm coming around the left, and if I've got my gun in my left hand, you know, I have to force myself so hard to use my left eye so that I'm still, you know, so that it's the same as if I was coming around the corner using my right, you know, and I struggle doing that because my dominant eye is my right eye. So, you know, I just figure, you know what, let's just keep it simple. Chances are I'm going to end up exposing my head about the same amount anyway, especially if I forget I'm not using my left eye and I'm still using my dominant eye. So I'm just going to sight with my dominant eye. I'm going to use my dominant hand, and I'm going to, you know, really, really lean out from the waist as I am slowly coming around that corner. And that's my technique. So,
yeah, it's always better to be efficient than, you know, try to do all these different techniques to try to, you know, I learned this or I saw this in a movie or something like that. It's better to be efficient. Chances are you're not carrying a ton of rounds on you. You know, you have a limited number of rounds. And if you're not as proficient shooting with your, you know, offside, going around cover, and you're wasting rounds just, you know, hoping that you hit the target because you, you know, because you think that you're exposing less of your body when truthfully you could probably expose just a little bit more and effectively end that threat. I think, you know, you definitely want to go with the latter option.
Yeah, and I think a lot of SWAT and tactical type teams would agree with just leave the gun in your strong hand. If you watch these guys train, and I've had the privilege of watching some of them. I haven't been a SWAT guy or anything like that, but I've watched some of these guys train before, worked alongside some of them even. And when they're clearing a room, a house, a building, they're just, you know, just watch how they operate and do what they do, because I guarantee that, you know, their goal is to be one, efficient and effective, but also to return home safe. So anyway, cool. Great. I think we've done, you know, pretty good justice to the topic there. Appreciate your input, gentlemen. And so let's get into our first news story. First up, this is out of East Memphis, Tennessee, and the title of the story is a 16-year-old is killed during attempted robbery in East Memphis. Now, first of all, as usual, Riley, being a parent and a dad, has to say, I feel really bad for the family of this 16-year-old, and I feel bad a 16-year-old is dead. But let me get into the story, and once the details are clear, I think it's obvious, you know, that this is just the way these sort of things go down. So you have a man and a woman, they're sitting in a car in front of a home. It's like 1:30 in the morning. I read that and I'm picturing date night, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, boyfriend's dropping the girlfriend off, you know. So they're sitting in front of this house in a car. And a couple of suspects, I think it was three suspects, approach the car and attempt to rob or carjack this couple. And the 16-year-old kid fires shots into the car, and the driver of the car, who is hit, by the way, he's hit in the side of his body, he apparently he's got his gun, and he's able to draw quickly and return fire from the vehicle and strikes this 16-year-old kid, who unfortunately succumbs to his wounds. But so in the introduction of the episode today, I said, hey, kids, you know, heads up. If you try to rob people with guns, it doesn't end well. I know we don't have to tell our own kids that, because they understand that concept. But
cross your fingers, yeah.
Yeah, but my goodness, you know, like, boy, it makes my heart kind of set. You know, I'm definitely sad when I hear stuff like this, but it's like, what are you going to do? I mean, he shot at you, and so you're going to shoot back. I don't care how old he is.
Yeah, here's a couple of thoughts. One, I have to assume, obviously, like without any question, that the driver who shot back must have listened to episode 16 of our podcast last week. Yeah, that's clear. You know, he very effectively responded. So I'll ask him later, you know, but I'm pretty sure he might. But on a more serious topic, a couple interesting things I thought about, you know, it, Well, I was thinking about this. This happened in Memphis, Tennessee. I don't think that there's any part of this country that's completely safe. You know, I don't think there's anywhere where we can just feel like, you know, life is good. I think sometimes we hear about the gun violence in you know, New York City and Chicago. You know, this is Memphis. I don't know a lot about crime rate in Memphis, Tennessee. I suspect that they have problems like everybody else. But if you know, for you teenagers, you know, Riley gave you a piece of advice, you know, don't go trying to shoot people, they'll shoot back. My piece of advice would be, you know, if you want to be a criminal, like, you should move to New York City or New Jersey. Like, that would be far better. Like, Memphis, Tennessee seems like a real bad place to try to, you know, shoot at people.
Yeah, I hear you there. I was just thinking too, you know, I mean, when you said how nowhere in this country is really, you know, safe. Jacob, you and I are based here at Denver in the Denver area. Denver, compared to some of the other major metropolitan areas, is actually, you know, statistically relatively safe. But yet we still have crap happen all the time. I think there was just a couple days ago a carjacking I don't think he actually succeeded. I think it was a carjacking attempt. But anyway, point is, these sort of things happen just about anywhere you go. We also had something I might have mentioned it in an earlier episode. There was a separate carjacking incident about 6-7 weeks ago where the suspect ended up in my neighborhood, in my quiet little neighborhood here, and ran through my backyard just before police arrested him and tackled him in the driveway of my neighbor's house. So, I mean, yeah, you're right. Like, nowhere is truly safe, and thus we need to be prepared. And so I totally agree. That was my thought when I read the story too. Yeah, this guy totally listened to episode 16 about using, you know, gun tactics from within a vehicle. So, yeah, what's your take on this, Matthew?
No, absolutely. I mean, and that's where kind of it goes into the idea of where, you know, when do you carry? You know, sometimes people say, well, do you need to carry your gun? We're just going to the grocery store. Do you need to do this or that? And it's, you don't, unfortunately, no one has a crystal ball that says, okay, today's the day that, you know, I'm going to be doing something innocuous and I'm going to be attacked, right? Obviously, there are certain areas that you go to that are probably higher probability, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, pretty much anywhere, probably more likely to become a victim of something or a target of something. But, you know, sometimes you can't keep from doing certain things. Some people work in bad areas, have to travel at night, work at night. So you can't, you know, when some people say, I only carry certain times, I like to have the mindset, you know, you never know when that event's going to happen. So you always have to be ready, not just certain, you can't just turn it on and off. And this guy obviously didn't take anything for granted, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm reminded too, with your comment, Matthew, about, you know, like, where do you carry and when do you carry? I think it's probably pretty evident that we all carry all the time. I mean, I'm sitting here at my home office doing this podcast, and I've got my Glock 17 on my waist. You know, like, it's always with me. And I'm reminded too, this was just yesterday. Are you guys familiar with Colleen Noir?
No.
Yeah.
He's got quite a big following on YouTube and things. He does all these videos and whatnot. But he posted on Twitter yesterday, this is his quote, "Nothing more annoying than when someone asks if you really need to bring your gun. You got that seatbelt on for a 2-minute drive, though." I just felt like that was right up the alley of this conversation.
Yeah, you know, like, absolutely.
You know, even my wife, to an extent, like, has sometimes made little jabs at me, like, "Oh, do you really got to take your gun for this little whatever we're doing?" And it's like, yeah. So, excellent. Let's move on. So, some legislative updates. We've got, in Arizona, Governor Ducey signs important pro-gun legislation.
Is that how you really say his name, Ducey?
That's what it looks like to me.
That's great.
I guess I could have looked it up ahead of time, you know, like, actually, like, sort of tried to prepare for Dusty, the podcast, Ducey, or something.
Either way, I just...
It looks like Ducey to me.
That's a rough name.
Okay, I'm sorry, Governor Ducey, because you actually did a good thing by signing two important pro-gun bills, Senate Bill 1266 and House Bill 2338. What are these bills, you ask? Well, one of the bills, House Bill 2338, prevents educational institutions from adopting policies that would prohibit individuals from lawfully possessing or carrying a firearm in their vehicle or on their person on a public right-of-way. So, hey, that's pretty cool. All right. And then Senate Bill 1266 is an important bill which ensures consistency in gun laws throughout the state by strengthening the state's current preemption statutes. This is coming to us from the NRAILA.org website. And so why is this important? And let me just talk about a little bit about preemption. And I'm not an attorney, okay? So here, there's my disclaimer, first of all. But state preemption statutes sometimes can be controversial. Personally, boy, you know, I'm the type of individual that definitely is always for more localized government. But there are some instances where some higher up control sometimes makes sense. I'm sure I'm going to get some hate mail on this. But states like Arizona, Colorado, and there's a whole bunch of other states too. But preemption statutes are not an unusual thing at all. But for instance, like in Colorado, the state has certain laws that basically, you know, that's essentially the law of the land for all the state of Colorado. And the preemption statute says that basically a city or a county or some other lower jurisdiction can't do something that counters the state's preemption statute or goes against the state. And so for a long, this is where it gets interesting in Colorado, because Colorado has a preemption statute that, you know, as far as open carry was the law of the land in all of Colorado until a few years ago, when some liberal activist judges sided with the city of Denver and said Denver can override this preemption and prohibit open carry within the city and county of Denver. So much for that preemption statute. But in Arizona, essentially what they've done is strengthened to a degree some of these preemption statutes. And one of those is, like I said, is so that an educational institution can't restrict people's gun rights when they are on a public right of way. And I think that's completely reasonable. What do you guys think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm with you. I mean, I am all for you know, delegating legislative stuff towards more of the people, but in kind of normalizing laws across the state, it makes it a lot less confusing for people that want to exercise their rights and understand what's going on. From, I mean, you know, some of these county lines and city lines can be so choppy, and you don't know one street you're here. The next, you know, you walk across the street and all of a sudden, I mean, it you could be violating the law. So I think it's very confusing. I know in Ohio we had some issues with that specific law involving dropping kids off at schools and daycare centers, where, you know, it was interpreted as kind of letter of the law that you're on the school property, whether or not you're in your vehicle with your concealed carry firearm in your vehicle and you're just dropping off your child, you're still on school grounds. And that kind of got clarified, you know, through some case law and things like that and legislative action to kind of say, hey, if you're just in the process of dropping off your kid and you're not getting out of your vehicle or going on the grounds, that was more the intent of that law. So I think, you know, these kind of things definitely clear up the ability for people that want to, obviously the people that care about this are the people that want to follow the law and they want to follow the law. But if the law is too confusing or contradictory, it's hard for them to know exactly what's going on. So I think these kind of bills and things really help the people that want to obey the law.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. Cool. Great summary. I'm going to move on to, I actually didn't preview this story, but it is in the title of the episode. George Zimmerman is back in the news. The title of this article is, it's from the USA Today, bids in George Zimmerman gun auction up to $65 million. So let me preview this a little bit. We all know who the famous George Zimmerman is. And he, of course, got his fame from shooting a little kid. Oh, boy. Trayvon Martin, okay? And he gets off the hook, but his Kel-Tec PF9 handgun, apparently he's got it back in his possession, and he is trying to raise some money. So he initially listed the gun on gunbroker.com, and it was very quickly taken down. Gunbroker said, no, we want nothing to do with this. You know, the gun that killed Trayvon Martin. And in their terms and conditions, in their contract, you know, when you list things, they can terminate any listing basically for any reason is what it says. So that's what they decided to do here. That's probably a wise move, I would suspect. So George Zimmerman takes his gun now over to it's a United Gun Group. And which I have to admit, I'm not terribly familiar with. I've been trying to get on their website all morning. It's totally crashed. And apparently because people are bidding like crazy on this gun. So up to $65 million. I'm not so sure I buy that. Mm-hmm. Like, I wouldn't buy it. Right? I wouldn't buy it, but like, how? I just don't see how this is possible.
Might be Dr. Evil is bidding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it says that the most recent bid topping $65 million is by someone identified as Craig Bryant. Mr. Craig Bryant, whoever you are, you're welcome to send a little bit of your wealth my way. And
he probably works for Michael Bloomberg. He's probably going to buy this and use it in some press campaign.
Yeah, I'm not so sure Michael Bloomberg would buy this thing for $65 million. I'm not convinced that whoever's bidding is actually going to follow through and pay up, you know. Like I just don't see it happening, but I'm still trying to get onto the United Gun Group website, cuz I was really curious. I'd like to kind of follow this. But George Zimmerman, I'm sorry guys, I got to take a little tangent here. Mr. George Zimmerman, if you're listening to this podcast right now, you're a flippin' idiot. That's all I have to say. Mostly because I honestly do not care what happened that fateful night in Florida with Trayvon Martin. I honestly do not care. But I know the way that George Zimmerman appears to be living his life since then, not cool. Not cool. Getting pulled over, causing issues with law enforcement, you know, issues with his girlfriend. I think he does a disservice to many, you know, law-abiding, normal, common sense-oriented gun people like us.
I agree totally.
Anyway, I couldn't help myself. I had to throw it out there. Anyway, moving on. NRA ILA reports, California hijacked bills are moving forward. And we touched on a couple of these a little bit, I think, in a previous episode. And we mentioned that, you know, some of the stuff that's being talked about in California and a few other places are just ridiculous and crazy. So here's some bills that have advanced, okay? So all four of these bills have passed the Senate Public Safety Committee. That means they are now going to go – now they're headed to the Senate Appropriations Committee. And once they – if they make their way through the Appropriations Committee, they'll be heard by the entire Senate in California, where it's certainly possible that they could be, you know, voted on and passed by the Senate. Of course, then it had to go to the House and be signed by Governor Brown, which wouldn't surprise me if he signed these kind of things. But what are we talking about here? Well, one bill would place unjustified and burdensome restrictions on the purchase of ammunition and would require the Attorney General to keep records of purchases. Wow. It would also require any online ammunition sales to be conducted through a licensed vendor.
Nuts.
Another bill would require an individual to request a serial number from the Department of Justice, that'd be the California Department of Justice, for curios, relics, and home-built firearms. Holy crap. Curios and relics have an exemption from a lot of laws for a reason.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah, and people are pissed off about this because, you know, you're going to take this curio or relic, which could be a very, you know, I mean, let me give an example. My father-in-law has a Civil War era, 1860, I can't remember which year it was built, but he's got a Springfield built muzzleloader from Civil War, okay? And it's in beautiful condition considering, you know, what it's been through and for how long it's been around. But very valuable gun. I don't remember exactly what he paid for it, but it was a lot of money, more than I have. And this would require people like this in California to then stamp their, you know, very valuable curio and relic exempted firearm with a serial number. So you can imagine why people are upset. And then some other, there's two other bills. One would reclassify semi-automatic rifles as assault weapons. Basically, if it has a magazine capable of being removed, even if it's with a tool, the so-called bullet button, which is one way, you know, that's one thing that a California compliant AR-15 might use. That's so that you can't just quickly remove the magazine and exchange with a fresh magazine, at least easily. That exempted, if you had certain things, right, you were able to not fall under the assault weapon ban in California with your AR-15s. Well, this would basically would say, you know what, if it has a removable magazine at all, like we don't care if there's a bullet button or anything like that, or whatever, if it's got a removable magazine and it's semi-automatic, it's going to be an assault weapon. So all of a sudden, AR-15s are definitely on the chopping block, as well as a whole host of other guns in California, potentially. And finally, an Assembly Bill 1511 would end the longstanding practice of temporarily loaning a firearm for lawful purposes. So you want to loan your friend a gun just so they can go to the range or whatever? Like, even though you know your friend is a law-abiding citizen and a good guy and he's not going to do anything bad with it, that will be illegal. Wow. Your take.
Well, I worked in California as a police officer, so none of this really surprises me. but, yeah, you just scratch your head and it's just kind of one of those things where you can't imagine that these things are actually thought about, but they obviously are, and gained enough traction to get to this level. But hopefully there's some common sense pumped in here before these actually become law.
Yeah. These are just insane laws. This is why I've always said California is a beautiful place to visit. I would never want to live there. Okay, now I'm going to get some hate mail from Californians.
Hey, they got Disneyland. My kids love Disneyland.
Yeah, totally. So if you're listening to this podcast and you are a California resident, and I know we have a lot of you, I know we have a lot of people that we do business with in California. We have a ton of people that order stuff from our website. We've got an instructor in California in the Sacramento area that teaches a lot of students every month. And, you know, take action. Start contacting your representatives and do it now. Particularly, I would focus right now on members of the Senate Appropriations Committee and start hitting them up and letting them know this is not cool. So that's all we can do. I mean, other than wait till the next election and hopefully elect better people. But moving on, things are looking better in New Hampshire, I think. And New Hampshire is an interesting place. So news story here is House approves concealed carry bill. This bill, in New Hampshire, you basically have right now a somewhat conservative legislature, but a less conservative governor. I believe it's a Democrat governor, Governor Hassan, or I hope I'm saying that right. Governor Maggie Hassan. Anyway, she said she will veto this bill. This is the concealed carry bill. And I've included in the show notes the text for what the bill actually says and how it reads. And if you look at that, the only thing they are basically changing, other than their permits will go from 4-year permits to 5-year permits, which brings it in line with a lot of other states' permits. But the other thing that's changing is this verbiage. They remove from the statute where dealing with concealed carry of weapons permits. they remove this phrase, and that the applicant is a suitable person to be licensed, and replace it with, unless the applicant is prohibited from possessing a firearm by state or federal statute. What does this do? Like, what's the big deal here? Well, the way the law is currently worded gives police chiefs and sheriffs in New Hampshire a little bit of an out. They actually are not truly a shall issue state. They are technically, according to the statute, the way it reads, a may issue state. In general, most anybody that applies for a permit in New Hampshire gets it. But it is possible, and there have been reports of law enforcement officers, chiefs, and sheriffs that have withheld permits for political reasons because they didn't like somebody. Or somebody didn't contribute to their campaign or whatever. And that's not cool. That's the reason why we always push for these shall issue statutes. And that's essentially what this is doing. But the governor is not happy with it, and the law enforcement officers in New Hampshire are not happy or in support of this bill.
Yeah, we need to change. I mean, I think we know that there's lots of states where these are challenges, where people, just because of where they've chosen to live, pay taxes, and have employment, they can't properly defend themselves where they go. So I hope this passes. I don't think it's that drastic of a request to make that kind of a change.
No, I don't either.
I don't think either.
Yeah. Yeah. So opponents of the bill, their viewpoint is that, you know, I think the biggest complaint is that they feel like this would handcuff those that issue concealed carry licenses. That was a quote from Representative David Welch, who's actually a Republican representative. And so he's obviously not in favor of it, which kind of surprises me a little bit. But obviously, you know, I guess he feels like he's trying to stick up for his local police chiefs and other law enforcement people. I don't see this as being a handcuffing at all, because essentially, if they got reason to believe, like if someone has mental health issues, if they've got something in their past that would prohibit them from owning or carrying a firearm, I mean, that's their out, okay? That's their out. The Second Amendment exists because law-abiding citizens can keep and bear their arms without infringement, is what the Second Amendment says. So, you know, it should be a shall issue. That's always been my stance, you know. Even better, constitutional carry, you know, right? But you know, shall issue. That's not handcuffing these guys' hands, okay? If there's a genuine reason why a person can't have a permit, they've got the out, all right?
Yeah, so I think seeing it as a handcuffing is actually opposite. I think it's more liberating and removing a lot of the onus or the liability, because now there's no hey, we're not going to issue to this person because, you know, we kind of don't like this person's ideas or anything. It's cut and dry. Yeah. Are they legally able to own the firearm? And that's you know, black and white. Are you legally able to? If you are, then you get it. If you're not, then, you know, sorry. You know, I don't see it as handcuffing at all.
Well, totally. It seems to be working in most states in this country. Like, you know, show me the example where we have similar laws and bad people are getting guns. Like, it's working everywhere else.
Yep. Yeah, we already know, and we're preaching to the choir when we say that violent crimes committed with guns by concealed handgun permittees, is a very rare circumstance. It almost never happens. So, great. Let's get into, we've got two more stories, and they are both justified stories. The first one, Jacob, I'm going to ask if you'll take this one on. It's from Cincinnati.com. The title is Concealed Carry Holder Shoots Man in North College Hill.
Yeah, down from Matthew there. So, yeah. So what happens here is Verlin, I think that's how you say his name. He's a concealed carry permit holder, and he claims that he was being assaulted by three people, a man and two women, and he said he was scared. He thought one of them might have a gun or something like that, and so he essentially drew his own gun and shot back.
Yeah. So did you see this reported locally, Matthew?
I didn't, but I read the article once you guys popped it up. Yeah, I think this is one of those issues where, you know, because there's only one side of the story and the other people kind of don't want to come forward, they probably are bearing some of the, a big portion of the guilt anyways in this whole scenario. So, and at least it ended well, right? No one died, no one got injured, no one innocent got harmed or anything. So,
and it goes without saying that I love these stories because, and there's a part of me that I had this thought as I was preparing show notes for today that I'd love to start like keeping count of lives saved this year by the use of a gun, you know, in a justified manner, because we feature these stories every week and we're always picking, you know, from a crop, a whole host of stories, you know, and it's like every week there's something that happens every week. And I personally believe because there's a lot of things that I'm positive that don't get reported or, you know, as far as like, especially don't maybe, you know, hit the headlines in the media so much. I personally believe every single day in this country, someone saves their life with a gun. And I know I can't back that with a fact, but with solid evidence, because the reason I just stated, there's a lot of things that probably go unreported for the most part. But I love this story because, you know, you got a dude that's obviously outnumbered. He's attacked by three people. And I, you know what? Even with the training I do have, as far as like hand-to-hand combat type stuff, I would be scared too if I got three people jumping on me. So, you know, when it says here that the man stated he was scared, that he thought they might have a weapon, so he fired, I totally get it, and I am proud of him for doing so.
And for those out there that probably read it or listen to it and say, oh, it was one man and two females, anybody who's been in a fight with one or two females, you know, as a police officer, they fight just as hard and just as violently as males. And, you know, anybody who thinks otherwise is kind of setting themselves up for failure.
Well, we just had, locally here, we just had a felony domestic violence arrest, that was a female. The perpetrator was the woman. You know, like, yes, I understand most domestic violence issues are probably the man that's involved or that's doing it. But this is a felony domestic violence case with a woman. So, I mean, she hurt her significant other pretty badly. Anyway, final justified story.
Ooh, I like this one.
That's why I saved it for last. Great Granny, 80. So 80 years old, got a gun, kills a home intruder who attacked husband. So, and there's even a picture of this lady. She looks awesome. She reminds me of my grandma. 80-year-old great grandma, she had to grab her gun and use it. What happened? Well, you had an intruder that broke in and was beating her husband with a crowbar and stabbed him with a knife. So she ran, grabbed her gun, a 38 caliber pistol, and her husband's bleeding on the floor. And she fires, I think, four times, and three of the shots hit the intruder. And he kills him. So, I mean, this is what she had to do. I mean, her husband, he's going to recover. He's going to be okay. He's listed in stable condition, it says. But that's pretty serious. You know, you got a 75-year-old man, her husband, being beat with a crowbar and stabbed. And this is what she has to resort to.
Yeah, no doubt she would have been next in his sights if she wouldn't have done that. So, outstanding.
Yeah, the BG in this case was previously convicted on a similar charge. You know, this is a repeat offender. It's funny you were talking about, you know, trying to account for all the lives saved, you know, so far this year. It's hard sometimes because, you know, we review these news stories and we don't know what would have happened. Right, we don't always know what would have happened. Sometimes we have a better glimpse, and this is probably one of those where we have a little bit better idea of where this would have gone if the gun had not been introduced, because we already had one person bleeding on the floor, you know, was stabbed with a knife, and I think that's really interesting. I also really appreciate that, you know, senior citizens in our society are in a unique position to act. They tend to be home more often. They tend to often be singled out as potential victims because criminals think they're easier victims in many cases. Mm-hmm. And so I see stories like this and I think, you know, what a great example you are. Now, the news story, the link we're sharing to foxnews.com is cool because after this incident was all over, the great granny here, Barb, I think is her name, she agreed to tell her story to Fox. And I appreciate that because she's not doing that for her own edification. She's doing that because in her mind, she's trying to probably empower and encourage other people like her. And I think that's the key point here.
Absolutely. That's a great point to make. And it is wonderful to hear. It's refreshing. It's like, you know, we obviously know there are really bad, scary people in our society today. But if my grandma, can use a gun, that's the way I look at this. This is my grandma. This is Jacob's grandma. This is all of our grandma that is able to be empowered, as you said, and successfully defend herself. By the way, there's a little towards the bottom of the article. It's reported that the gun was a Christmas gift from her husband.
I'm glad you pointed
that
out.
That's the best gift he ever gave her.
Yeah, yeah. That's
right. Yeah, came back for his sake in a big way. So,
I think this is a great story to kind of underscore about trying to further limit the elderly being able to even purchase or own handguns, through legislation to say, they're old, obviously elderly, some have dementia and things like that, shouldn't have guns, but just simply because, you're elderly doesn't mean that you don't have the facility or the faculties about yourself to competently protect yourself and stop a threat. So I think that's outstanding.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, she's a good shot. She got 3 out of 4 shots on target.
Under stress. That's better than a lot of people can do. The gun, the great equalizer. Here we had 80-year-old woman, 75-year-old man against 25-year-old man. The gun is the great equalizer. Fantastic. Well, I think that's it for today, unless you guys got anything else to add. But finding the right gun to carry can be a lifelong challenge. That is why we prepared a downloadable ebook called Purchasing Guide, Self-Defense Handguns. This guide includes legal, ethical, and safety concerns when shopping, in addition, of course, to the strong and clear approach to determining the best handgun for you and your situation. Also included is 3 steps to help you save 20% off your next handgun purchase. The book is available in our online store at usafirearmtraining.com/shop for only $10, or it is free to those with our Patriot membership, which if you don't know what that is, check it out. You'll see it there and also in our online store. It has many, many other benefits. So Patriot members, Jacob, what do they get? Just so we can prime the pump, so to speak.
Yeah, they get a lot of free stuff that normally costs money, like this book we're talking about. But Patriot members just have a flat, always good discount on all purchases on the online store, including ammunition.
Which is huge. I mean, you can save a lot of money potentially that way. And Patriot membership is not expensive at all either. It's, what is it, $10 a month?
$10.
Yeah, that's not much at all, especially if you're buying a lot of ammunition or anything. That'll save you a lot of money real fast. So, awesome. Check that out. And later in this week on the Concealed Carry podcast, we will be talking about, the title is To Chamber or Not to Chamber. And we're going to have Matthew back on again because he actually wrote a really fantastic article about, do I carry my gun with a round chambered or not? What are the considerations here? Pros, cons, all of that. Did a really great job with it. So that's why we've invited him back to do episode 18. And I can't hardly believe it. It seems like it wasn't that long ago that we were, Jacob, we did episode 10 where we announced that we were going to the twice a week format. And here we are already to number 18. It's hard to believe. That'll be coming up this Wednesday. So you'll be listening to this podcast on Monday, most likely, May 16th. So check out Wednesday's episode, May 18th, for episode number 18. to learn about carrying with around in the chamber. As always, we'd like to encourage you to subscribe to the podcast on your mobile or listening device. This is the surest and easiest way of always having access to the podcast. If you need help with either mobile podcast apps or with how to subscribe, please go to usafirearmtraining.com/subscribe-to-podcast. And that is two is spelled out T-O. So subscribe-to-podcast. And that would be after the usafirearmtraining.com. And of course, you'll always find the links to things like that. Anything we mentioned on the podcast, you'll find in the show notes. And in case it's not clear, show notes are found on our website where we post the podcast episode. If you scroll down a little bit further, you'll see all the notes that we're talking about. And also, thank you so much if you're already following us and liking us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, all these various social medias. We really appreciate it. And if you haven't already subscribed / liked / whatever, followed, you are totally missing out. Why haven't you done it yet? So go and do that now. Facebook is probably where we are most active, but our Instagram following is constantly growing. We're always posting stuff to Instagram. I know Jacob's always on top of that. So check it out. And once again, we thank you so much for the support of this podcast. We really appreciate it. You guys, our listeners, all the comments we get, the feedback we receive, emails, everything, it seriously drives and motivates us to continue doing this. And it's also made possible because people like you are kind enough to go to our online store and purchase some of the products we talk about, or also from our advertising partners. And so we really appreciate that. It makes it everything possible. We would ask one last thing of you. If you haven't done so already, please, please, please go to iTunes. That's Apple, right? Apple iTunes. Leave a review, please. That's like the best thing ever. We check it every day. We log in, we go, oh, new review, awesome. And then there's days it's like, oh, no reviews today. So we'd love to get some more reviews of the podcast. Let us know how we're doing. So if we can, we'd love to improve. Or if you're letting us know we're doing a great job, well, it just, once again, further motivates us to keep doing a good job. To make it easy, there's a link in the show notes, usafirearmtraining.com/podcast review. Finally, with any questions, feedback, you can always contact us through our social pages, like I mentioned, or you can go to our contact page, usafirearmtraining.com/contact. So, Jacob, this is your opportunity to say goodbye.
Oh, yeah. Goodbye.
Thank you, Jacob. And Matthew?
Thank you very much for having me. It was a blast. I appreciate it.
And yeah, it was really our honor to have you on. A lot of valuable and good input. So with that, I'm Riley, bidding you farewell. We'll see you next time. We look forward to it. Bye-bye.